first I wanted to thank Word in Life, and especially Barbara Kahn, who suggested this topic and put me to work for the whole past year, doing all kinds of research. And a lot of it I did up in San Francisco, and even had to go to the library itself because certain books they wouldn't let out. So I had to sit there and do it. But it was well worth it, and this is a wonderful topic, as you will soon realize. And just a quick announcement about the books. This is my new one. It's called Wisdom's Way, Quotations for Contemplation. And they're divided into some on psychological growth, some on spiritual awareness, and some on mystical union. So these are all the quotations I've been using, and I'll be drawing from this occasionally during these talks. So if you're interested, they're on the table. And I also have a few left of the Mary Within, which was one of our topics in the past. So I'd like to begin with giving out this quotation from the book of St. Luke, which has a good summary of the main points of our topic. And there will be extra ones, so I'll put some on the table and just take as many as you would like to pass around. What I was doing when I was up in San Francisco, I made a bunch of these, you know, a few hundred of them, and every time I went to a coffee shop, I left some in the little rack, trying to spread the word. I thought maybe somebody will pay attention. Sure. So let's begin with just a comment that most of the experiences in life, and especially with institutions or organizations, have something to do with giving you comfort, and at the same time also have to challenge you. So let's use a simple example. The little birds in the nest are comforted by the warm breast of mother and by being fed. But at a certain point, they are pushed out of the nest and challenged to fly. Just comfort, that won't lead to the full experience of being an eagle. Just challenge, being kicked out of the nest the minute you were born, that's not going to work either. So it has to be a combination. And if you stop to think of it, this is true of a church, a religion, a school, a relationship. If it's really going to work for adult humans who live out of the archetype of a journey, then it has to offer some comfort, and it has to, at the same time, offer a challenge. So, for instance, in our religion, we have the comfort of the saints and the candles and the rituals and so forth that we all enjoy, but we also have the challenge of commandments and moral values by which to live. Everybody follow? So the Sermon on the Mount is in the realm of challenge. And we might feel uncomfortable with it because it has something to do with changing our ordinary values. It offers a new way of living that make the comforts secondary to the challenge. So this is why it's such a complex issue for most people. I remember in the seminary when we got to Matthew 5 and 6, which is the full Sermon on the Mount. The first thing the professor said was, "This is not to be taken literally. None of this is literal. You don't have to do any of this." And when we got to "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church," this is written, definitely literal. So what this calls for is some type of surrender. And I'll give you an interesting story that shows the surrender of what. Because when I was in the seminary, this Sermon on the Mount bothered me. I thought, wow, I don't think I could ever do all this stuff. And I wondered why it bothered me. I couldn't figure it out. And I used a technique that I sometimes use when I don't understand something, which is I copy it out longhand over and over again until I understand. So I sat at my desk and I started copying out word for word. And then all of a sudden, I stopped and I said to myself, "Oh, this is trying to break down my big fat ego. And that's why I don't like it." Well, then I understood, okay, this is about the surrender of your ego. What's our ego in this instance? It's when the intense and lasting desire to make sure that you come first, that you're always right, that you always win. And all of that would have to go if you're going to follow something as powerful as this. So it's a surrender of ego, which is the equivalent of a surrender to Christ's way. And it's stated very well by Teilhard de Chardin. A union with Christ means the radical sacrifice of egoism. So this is the calling that comes from this particular part of the teaching. And I have one more quotation from J.R.W. Stott. This is a Protestant theologian. "The only alternative," when about the Sermon on the Mount, the only alternative is to take Jesus at his word and his claims at their face value. In this case, we must respond to the Sermon on the Mount with deadly seriousness, for here is his picture of God's alternative society. This is what the world would look like if it were not run by presidents, but run by saints. These are the standards, the values, and the priorities of the kingdom of God. Only when the Christian community lives by Christ's manifesto will the world be attracted and God be glorified. So when Jesus calls us to himself, this is what he's calling us to. For he is the Lord of a counterculture." So what's on your little handout? Namely, the quotation from St. Luke, who has a short version of the Sermon on the Mount called the Sermon on the Plain. chapter 6, verses 17 to 49. That's Christ's manifesto. That's the calling that we're referring to. And by the way, as I go along, just raise your hand if you have any questions. So this is by way of introduction. Now let's look at a central concern, if we're ever to appreciate this whole thing, which is trust in God. What exactly is meant by that? Does it mean you don't follow the Islamic saying, "Trust Allah, but tie the camel"? So it has to be some type of combination. It's basically that God somehow becomes a main resource. So you ask yourself, what do I mainly rely on? And remember this quotation from Gone with the Wind? This is when, toward the end of the film, when Scarlett realizes that she's now alone because the husband left her. And she starts to hear voices in her head from her father especially. Because now she's saying, oh, now what shall I do? And she hears the voice in her head. Would you mean to tell me, Katie Scarlett O'Hara, that the red earth of Tara doesn't mean anything to you? That's where you get your strength. So for her, the main resource was the land. In fact, one of the sayings is, the land is the only thing that matters. So in the Sermon on the Mount, what we're being offered is the only thing that matters is trusting in God. I was reading an autobiography of Anita Caspary. She's one of the main figures in the Immaculate Heart story. And I copied this quote out of the book because it was very powerful. Remember that the order, their congregation was in trouble with the cardinal. So here's her statement. If our order is meant to survive, God will see to it that it does. I stopped short. I said, wow, this woman trusts in God. Because she could have said, if our order is meant to survive, then it will survive because of all that we're doing. But she's saying God will see to it that it does. That's the radical style of trust. It's trusting in a caring power. And it means that you're giving up your control over how things have to happen. In fact, control would be the opposite of trust in God. So that's one of the themes that we're going to see as we move through this. Everybody follow? So what is the central challenge, which would be the equivalent of a full conversion to Christianity? It would be that when you meet up with problems and crises, you trust in a power beyond yourself that will see to it that your capacity to go on loving will always be there. It's not trusting that some power beyond yourself will make your wishes come true. It's trusting that no matter what happens, whether the wish comes true or not, you'll still be able to love in this special way. What is this special way? It's right there in the little sheet. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. So it's love, do good, bless, and pray. Whom do you love? Your enemies, not just your friends. To whom do you do good? To those who hate you, not just to those who do good to you. You bless those who curse you, and you pray for those who abuse you. So if we were to list those as the practices, so it's love, do good, bless, and pray. These are the four callings that challenge us in the Sermon on the Mount. And for these, in order to have this happen in you, graces are given to you. So we all have the grace to do this part of the practice, which is love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Now let's compare those to what you have on your sheet. If someone strikes you on the one cheek, turn the other to him also. So that's the turn the other cheek. By the way, I'm going to go into detail on all of these as we go along. Now I'm just doing the overview. If someone steals one piece of clothing from you, give him another piece. So allow someone to steal from you. If someone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back. So it's not only allow stealing, it's not only turning the other cheek, it's not only give more than was unjustly taken. But somehow, you'd be giving up your rights. So let go of standing up for your rights in the way we have been taught to do. And this is in the definition of being a healthy adult. You should stand up for your rights. You should not just let people abuse you a second time after they abused you the first time. You should not give more to somebody who stole from you. You should not allow someone to steal from you. This set of challenges is different from the first set. Everyone can love, do good, bless, and pray. And graces are available to everyone for these. But for this side, turn the other cheek, give more, allow stealing, that would require a special calling. With special graces. It's important to see this distinction. We're going to see more about it later. Because this set is contrary to everything we've been taught. Now let me give a very simple example. Maybe you've heard of the saint Franz Jägerstätter. He was inducted into the Nazi army, and he refused to serve. And he was a simple workman, not a theologian. He went to jail, and the jailers liked him so much, they kept trying to convince him, just go ahead and sign the papers, and then we'll make sure that you're not going to be put into battle. We'll get you a job working with the wounded. They kept trying to convince him, don't do this. Don't defy the authorities because they're very mean-spirited. He said, no, I appreciate what you're saying, but no, I am not going to serve in any capacity. So finally, the parish priest came in and sat down with him in his cell and explained to him about the just war theory and about the legitimacy of Catholics to be part of an army, explained the whole thing, and said, you can join, it's not a sin. And he gave a very interesting answer. He said, I appreciate how you're trying to help me, but you were not given the special grace that I'm working from right now. Something has happened to me. I was given a calling. I was given a grace. I don't know why. And I have to follow it. So even though everything you're saying is right, even though it's okay not to turn the other cheek, not to give more, not to allow stealing, to go ahead and join the army, I can't do it because something happened to me. And this thing that happened to me, I can't say no to. So he stuck with his view, and as you may know, he was beheaded as a result. So he's a martyr to the Sermon on the Mount. Very powerful, isn't it? Very, very touching. And remember that he couldn't argue the theology because he was a simple soul. But he did understand. Something happened to me that didn't happen to you or any of these other people around me. So, it's also clear that if the Sermon on the Mount, which has to do with not retaliating, loving those who hate us, doing good to others, blessing, and so forth. If this is God's way of telling us who He is, then there can't be a hell of eternal punishment. Because He loves those who hate Him. And He blesses those who curse Him. And He does not punish or retaliate. So if you're really going to take this seriously, then it changes the traditional standard view that we were brought up with. And one other thing about this, which I also find very important, all through the ages there have been people who came to these same conclusions. This is not just a Christian perspective. You'll see this in Gandhi, you'll see this in Buddha, you'll see this all throughout history. There was always someone who came up with the idea, wait a minute, I'm going to offer a countercultural set of values different from the way the rest of the world is. And there were always heroic people who had these special graces. So it's really important to notice that and to say to ourselves, well, this is something in human nature. Most people operate from the opposite of the Sermon on the Mount. Get back at people who hurt you. If someone steals from you, be sure to retrieve what was taken and bring the person to court and make sure he's punished. That's one approach. And then there's this other approach. And there always have been people like, as I'll point out later, Quakers, Mennonites, and so forth, who even base their religion on this Sermon on the Mount. But it is a special calling, so don't feel bad if it's hard for you or if people steal from you to want to get yourself back. Because you have to have a special set of graces to do the opposite. Everybody follow? Here's the quote from the Jerusalem Bible. This is Luke 6:30. Do not ask for your property back from the man who robs you. That would be hard to do. And it's hard to see how this has something to do with salvation. It just seems like a very unfair, unreasonable advice. So that's part of what we're dealing with in this Sermon on the Mount. We're hearing things that just don't sit right with even the healthy ego, let alone the retaliatory ego. Even the healthy ego has a problem with this. So as we go through this, we'll try to address this issue. I just want to bring it up at the beginning. Questions?
It just seems to me like, you know, there's a thing about boundaries.
Yes.
And, you know,
somebody taking, somebody hitting you in the face is one thing, but giving them the other side of your face, somebody taking, you know, that's completely, seems like somebody who would operate out of that side, are they mentally healthy? A healthy person, to me, doesn't operate that way. That's a victim.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Of operating.
Yes, this is the opposite of what we've been taking all these years to find out from the self-help movement. You don't want to be a victim, you want to take care of yourself.
The woman on the mount is one thing, but that other over there is like, to me, doesn't seem very healthy.
This is the Sermon on the Mount.
That's part of the Sermon on the
Mount. Oh, no. Finally, you weren't listening to the whole sermon. Yeah, here you go.
Thank you. I thought
okay.
This was something different on today.
No. This is all part of the past staff.
Where do we resign?
Well, no, don't give up this fast, because we're going to work through this, and we're going to see over the course of these 3 weeks just how it all comes together.
The qualification of a special colleague is kind of what's bothering me.
Okay, go ahead.
Because God's grace is open and free and given to all. How, maybe it's how we respond to the grace that is special.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. In the seminary, they made this distinction, so this might help. What Barbara said fits. Everyone has access to all the graces. But in addition to graces, there are also charisms. I'll explain this. This part, C-H-A-R in Greek means thanks, as in Eucharist. U-E-U means beautiful. So Eucharist is the beautiful thanks. So a charism is a special grace or gift given to only to some people. Like, for instance, the charism of speaking in tongues, the charism of healing. It certainly isn't true that everybody has these powers, but some people do. And certainly saints have special charisms. So if you look at these, turn the other cheek, give, and so forth, as charisms, which that saint Franz Jägerstätter had, so did St. Francis, St. Clair, and others, that would be the distinction between the graces available to all. But say more, maybe you don't like this distinction.
No, I don't.
Okay,
I don't want anything that limits God's gift to us. Mm-hmm. So everybody has to have equal access to God's presence.
Well, now you're putting us all on the spot here, because
we have to earn it.
How do we explain that? We don't all want to turn the other cheek or give to those who steal from us.
But you see, at the end of that quotation, as I remember it, when we learned it a long time ago,
yeah,
that so you may be children of your Father in heaven, who makes his rain fall on the just and the unjust alike, and his sun to shine on the just. I remember that.
Yes.
That was what you're leading up to.
That you'd have the grace to be like,
yeah,
God.
And
okay. Alice?
Yeah.
I like to think of it as a special gift that somebody has necessarily that other people don't have. But having as a capacity, okay, I think of it in terms of myself and certain things that I can do that family members can't do. There's a capacity in me that I recognize to be able to do it. But I don't consider it to be something special to me apart from my history. In other words, there's a capacity in my family line, or capacity in the evolutionary process that came to rest in myself as a particular manifestation. So of being able to do a certain thing. I had this insight when my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, and it was my both my father and mother come from large families, and it was really just family affair, and my aunts were getting up and singing everything. I sat there and became so aware of the goodness in my family line, and I became aware that I can't take on myself my own goodness as though it's a gift given to me, when in fact it's connected to more than just myself. So I think people have capacities for something that other people don't have, but it's not something we can say was gifted just to us, but rather it's like the Jews. You know, they have the capacity to receive this inner word of God, but it's not as though other people didn't, but it's sort of the whole way the evolutionary process comes about. So I don't see it as wanting to grasp it and say, well, you know, this is something that I have, you know, that nobody
else
has.
That other people don't have.
But I consider it to be gifted to me on the shoulders of others that came before me. And so I feel the whole weight of them pushing behind me to fulfill this particular capacity. So it's connected to others.
And I'll come to you with just one other point, which might help with what Barbara brought up. The graces are, instead of thinking of the graces as given to each individual, think of it as the graces are given to the community. So I have this gift and you have that gift, and we put our gifts together, and that creates a wonderful world, as opposed to every single person gets every single one.
But you sort of went my direction a little bit. Last weekend, I remember First Presbyterian Church, and we had our session retreat, which is the elders' retreat, and our focus was on recognizing our missional abilities, and we were searching for our charisms, basically. We were only hoping for one, and in general, and in all honesty, the one we came up with was hospitality, but that as a community. So you see, you're going that direction.
Yeah.
It isn't always egocentric, but it's an ability to recognize what God's gifts are to you.
Because
we all have this.
And it makes community necessary when not everybody gets everything. Whereas if each person got everything, why do we need anybody else?
It's the whole body of Christ in 1 Corinthians, you know, the hand is the eye, and the, you know, each member of the body has its own special gift
contribution
for allowing the body to and the members with the least gifts are the ones given greater honor, you know, by the body. So, it's particularly
okay. This is a good discussion because it's helping us understand it a little better. There's no final answer. And Barbara's certainly right. All the graces are available. And yet, we notice that some people have more in one area than in another. It also reminded me of a little wonderful story from the life of St. Catherine Laboureil. She was a French nun who had a vision of the Virgin Mary. And Mary asked her to have this image struck as a medal. That became the miraculous medal, which you've all seen. It shows Mary standing in the posture that the ancient goddesses stood in when they were giving graces. It's facing you straight ahead with your hands outstretched like this, palms facing the people. And this is called the grace-giving pose. So she was standing like this. And she had rings in the vision. She had rings on all 10 fingers. And from some of the rings, there were streams of golden light. You've seen this image many times. And so she asks Mary, what are those streams of golden light coming from some of your fingers? Mary said, those are the graces that I'm giving to anyone who asks for them. And then St. Catherine said, what about the fingers that have rings, but they have no light coming from them? She said, those are the graces that I want to give, but no one has asked for. So this is another way of, it's a pious story, so we're not going to take it literally, but it does make a point, which is that we have hesitated on how much grace we could ask for. For instance, would you be willing to ask for the grace that if someone steals from you, you will allow it, and you will even give more? Would you like to ask for that grace?
Yes.
Okay.
Because God will provide.
That's why I'm saying it's connected to the trust. It all begins with trusting. You have to trust God as coming through because you chose to live this way. Most likely, Jesus did not actually stand on a mount. By the way, the reason it's on a mount is because Matthew's gospel is written for a Jewish audience. So he's showing that just as Moses stood on Mount Sinai, Jesus stands on a mount to give his law. Moses gave the Ten Commandments. Jesus gives the Sermon on the Mount. Everybody follow? But most likely he didn't actually say these words. As you will see, every single word in the Sermon on the Mount is taken from rabbinical sources. There's not one phrase in there that's original with Matthew. Or whoever wrote this, it's obviously not written by the person in the Gospel named St. Matthew, because, of course, it's in Greek. And it was begun probably in the year 90, and finally, the final version is about the year 117. But whoever wrote this was well-schooled in all the Jewish sources, Old Testament and other rabbinical sources I mentioned, and put together a summary of these special teachings. And look at the title of one of the books that I use. This is from 1911, Gerald Friedlander. Notice the title of the book, The Jewish Sources of the Sermon on the Mount. And I followed it very carefully in every single phrase. Like, the meek shall inherit the earth. You'll see that in Psalm 37, Psalm 25. There's also rabbinical writing, which is not included in the Old Testament, called the Book of Enoch. E-N-O-C-H, which also refers to this, meek shall inherit the earth. Inherit the earth does not mean inheriting the land. It means enter the Messianic kingdom. The meek shall enter the Messianic kingdom. And that is in Isaiah 40:21. So let's take what's called the law. We don't use this word much anymore, but talion, the law of talion, T-A-L-I-O-N. This is where you get retaliation. Tal in Latin means such. So do to others such as they do to you. That's the law of talion. And it's said, of course, that, well, that's the style of the Old Testament, and it is part of the style. But Leviticus, Proverbs, Lamentations, Job, Ecclesiasticus all propose the alternative, which is in the Sermon on the Mount. So there, even in the Old Testament, there is the concept of don't retaliate. This book had a couple of interesting points, which I'll share. The book wondered out loud whether Jesus himself followed the Sermon on the Mount. For instance, when he was slapped in the face by the high priest, he did not turn the other cheek. He said, Why did you slap him? He was indignant. Secondly, it seems clear that he didn't pray for his enemies. He called them a brood of vipers and whited sepulchres, and they're going to go into the fires of Gehenna. He didn't look like he showed much love for his enemies, and we're not hearing that he prayed for his persecutors. I mean, may have, but from what we see, it's hard to put that together completely. Another source book is called The Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. That's another part of rabbinical teachings that have exactly the same concepts as Sermon on the Mount. So this is a little bit about the background. Questions? Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Maybe that's the young Jesus, and before he died, he might evolve to a person that would forgive and just let go.
Yeah, we don't really know the full historical Jesus. We know the Christ of faith. Everybody knows that distinction. So there's a historical Jesus would be the man who walked around in Galilee, who died around the year 30. That's the historical Jesus, an actual person. We're sure that this person actually lived because there are records about him in Roman and Jewish history. In addition to the historical Jesus, we also met the Christ of faith. So Jesus is a name. That's the Latin version of the name Joshua, which means the anointed, the Savior. So that's his actual name. This is not a name. This is a Greek word that refers to a role that someone plays. What role is it? Messiah. The one who has come to bring salvation. So when you talk about Christ as the second person of the Blessed Trinity, now you're learning from the councils of the church, which gave us the Christ of faith. That type of consciousness was not in the man who walked around as a Jew in Galilee. He didn't think of himself as, I'm the second person of the Blessed Trinity. He didn't even know that word, Trinity. So, the Sermon on the Mount is a collection of sayings that fit what Christian piety would look like in the early period of our history. And it wasn't until about the 4th century, after Constantine was converted to Christianity, so 4th century, that you have the beginning statements about this Christ of faith, which is a much bigger, and sometimes they even contradict each other. Like Jesus says, the historical Jesus says, do not judge. The Christ of faith is the judge of the living and the dead. So sometimes what's in one looks a little different from what's in the other. So here's the point. that we don't know for sure what this historical Jesus actually said or did, but people like Crossan have helped us understand more and more. Yeah.
I have another concern.
Yeah.
When you first started your talk, we were talking about the trust of God.
Yeah.
And the niggling thing that comes to my mind is, we're still talking in dualistic language when you were presenting the love God, you know, do, and that God will provide. That's somebody out there versus me and somebody out there. It's a dualistic approach, right?
Yeah.
Thinking?
Yes.
But aren't we trying to pull those two together? And it's really me, God, you, God.
Fear not. As we go on, I will make sure that happens.
Isn't that dualism?
Our original version of trust in God, and, well, I mean, the type of religion that was taught to us was dualistic, in the sense that there's a God up in heaven and we're down here. And when we start talking, he listens. And then he answers yes or no. And that's what prayer is about. So it misses the whole other perspective, that it's all one, and that God is a power within us and in the universe, rather than the Michelangelo version of God up on the ceiling overseeing everything. So part of becoming more adult in one's faith is to make that transition from the God outside, who will make sure everything works out fine, and the oneness of nature, including human nature, and the divine. How does that connection show itself? Through living out the Sermon on the Mount. That's our tradition of how it shows itself.
That
fits. Good. Okay. All right, other questions about this? This is good, because we're having some good discussions about the whole topic. And you know what I also thought of? You know, how we were indoctrinated in our childhood catechism classes with all these teachings about Catholicism, like, for instance, being taught, well, we're the one true church, and being taught God is a Trinity, and being taught the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ, and so forth. Not that we're putting any of that down, but they could have taken all that time that went into that kind of indoctrination and instead indoctrinated us with the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
Can you imagine what wonderful people we'd be? Do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, etc. Instead of, now make sure you know that you're not supposed to chew the host, because that's Christ's body. See what I mean? If they're going to indoctrinate us, why not indoctrinate us in this part?
Because they didn't know.
Yeah, they didn't know. They weren't up to snuff on this question.
I'm fairly new to all of this, and I don't consider myself Christian at all, because I... earlier in my life read and learned all of these things, and to me the actions of people who were Christians were so against those things that I never got that they were, I always got that they were hypocritical. Mm-hmm. And I just returned from Peru, where not only did they not turn the other cheek or do all those things, they went in, they killed, enslaved, took millennia-old stones from ruin and built their churches. And so I'm just putting that out there as my point.
Yeah, we have a lot of history to repent of.
But don't you think we all always we have the idea, just on that point, that God eventually brings good out of evil, you know, in the whole big mix. But the other thing, as regards that, the difficulty of some ladies say, oh yes, saying, no, we don't want to do those things.
Yeah.
You know, give, not ask for your stuff back.
And all the other side of your
stuff.
Face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then the thing I'm thinking of, somewhere doesn't Jesus say, as you would, that men should do to you, so you do also to them in like manner. Even, you know, if you did steal from them, maybe you'd like that they wouldn't come and knock you on the head. And I don't know. I really think that we have to bear other people's burden. That's where mm-hmm. it's getting down to. We have to do the suffering without, I mean, it's a grace, I suppose. But to begin to see that as you would, that men should do to you, so you do to them also like that. That's if you get that inner grace, you know, each one separate, different, but it does, it kind of links around it.
And the golden rule is what you're mentioning, which is part of the Sermon on the Mount. Anita?
One of the things that crosses my mind is turning the other cheek and letting people steal is the idea of offering a person another chance. Mm-hmm. Because so often somebody does something wrong in their life mm-hmm. and they are forever labeled, oh, he's a liar or she's a stealer or this or that. And it's that turning and saying, you know, let's try this again. I'll give you another chance.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. I like that. Yes. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
I heard recently a quote that was, don't judge someone unless you have been free of that.
Don't cast the first stone. Right.
I was just thinking when Anita was talking that I heard Crossan one time give a sermon on repentance and forgiveness, and he said forgiveness is God giving you time.
Good way to put it. Alice?
I just want to honor this man's statement about Jesus and say, you know, with Gandhi gave the same reason why he couldn't become a Christian, because he never saw a Christian actually following Jesus. But, you know, it's sad as a Christian, and I'm grateful that there are enough models and somehow stuck with it to see the thread running through the Christian tradition of models, disciples of Jesus. But how sad, you know, for the historical person of Jesus trying to make a difference in the world, make manifest our actually highest aspirations, to have been so misrepresented by the community that instituted itself in his name. It even today is still a sadness that it doesn't take away from that historical person and the life that he lived.
The wise man, I knew, shall rest his soul, used to make quite a bit, and it sunk into me finally, made a big distinction between churchianity and Christianity.
Mm. Good point.
And I tried to live by that.
Very good distinction.
I also just came back from Peru and heard the same things you did and saw what the Incas and how they suffered and how the church came in, the Spanish came in and put a church, 3 or 4 or 5 churches in every city. There's a Dominican, a Jesuit, all of them in every city built on top of the Incan temples. And I think that I had to go back to Christ didn't, he wasn't a Catholic. No, it was the church that did that. And it was the Spanish church that did that. It was awful what they did through. Mm-hmm. It was awful. And we have to, that's part of our history.
And acknowledge that and ask forgiveness. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to take a break, but before we do, I just wanted to read one quotation more. This is from Thomas Merton. At the center of our being is a point of nothingness which is untouched by sin and by illusion. It's a point of pure truth, a point or spark belonging entirely to God. And it's inaccessible to the fantasies of our mind or the brutality of our will. That little point of pure space and absolute poverty is the glory of God in us. So that's what we ultimately trust. That there's something inside that you can always go back to that does want the pure teaching and does open to the graces. Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll continue.